What's up, guys? Welcome back to episode number 10 of 25 Feet High Outdoors Podcast. Before we get into what we're going to get into today, I figure we start out by covering our partners with the show. Starting off, we have World Championship Outdoors, which is your South Alabama Hoyt and Matthews dealers. You can check them out on Facebook. We also have Black Eagle Arrows. They provide superior arrow technology from the tournament trail to the hunting woods. We have Threads Custom Bowstrings, family owned and operated, providing the fastest turnaround in the industry. Pre-stretch strings. If you're in the market for a new set of strings, call Threads Custom Bowstrings and tell them 25 High sent you. We also have Native Scents. It is a truly Alabama owned and formed deer urine scent company. It's 100% natural, collected for hunters by hunters. Native Scents, we get results. All right, so before we get into this, I'm very excited about this conversation I had with an author and a forester, a hog hunter named Mark Haynes. He is a very interesting guy. We had a very good conversation, but I would like to kind of pre-apologize for the fact that this is the first interview that I've ever conducted. This is the first time I've ever ran the podcast and everything, so the subjects kind of jump around a little bit. It's a little rocky, but hopefully you'll get as much enjoyment out of it as I did. Y'all stay tuned, and without further ado, enjoy the show.
I started hunting at 6 years old, and I can't think of a time I wasn't obsessed with it. My first bow at 4, first deer at 7. I have my dad to thank for getting me into such an amazing sport.
Hunting trip for 25 high today.
And I thank God for this opportunity.
Hunting is so much more than killing an animal. It's about family, friends, and this lifestyle so many of us can never live without. It's about the conservation of not only the wildlife and wild lands we know and love, but also of this culture for generations to come.
Dear Lord, I'm so grateful for the Lord around me. Lord, this is beautiful body.
I got a freaking giant bass!
25 feet high, baby. This is awesome.
All right, guys, welcome back to the 25 Feet High Outdoors podcast. Got a pretty exciting episode for you guys today. We're joined by Mark Haynes, and he is an author and a forester. And from what sounds of it, sounds like you wear quite a few hats, actually.
Yeah, there's several of them. That's right.
So right off the bat, I would just like to kind of go over what I want to talk about.
Okay.
The kind of the highlights is I want to talk about your background a little bit.
Sure.
And, of course, talk about your book.
All right.
And then talk about your hunting style for hogs. By the way, we're going to be talking about hog hunting.
I hear you.
And also just hogs in general.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty excited about this.
I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So from your book, it's called Year of the Pig.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting book. You mentioned you were in the service.
That's right.
And then you got into forestry. Can you explain, like, what got you into forestry?
I can. I grew up sixth generation on a family farm. And that was back in the 80s. It was a pretty tough time to be growing up on a small farm. A lot of our neighbors were going bankrupt, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I know I wanted to work outside. Okay. And I went and visited the University of Missouri Columbia while I was still in high school, and found out they had a forestry program, and of course that would allow me to work outside. I had also went in and talked to an Army recruiter. So you mentioned me being in a service, and I signed up for the U.S. Army Reserves. And what they allowed at that time was what they called a split option. I'd go straight from high school, graduate in high school to basic training. I'd go do my freshman year of college, and next year I'd do my MOS, my specialty. in the following summer, and then I'd serve in the reserves, and they'd give me some money for the GI Bill, and that worked right up until the first Persian Gulf War, and I got called out before I graduated for 5 months, and then came back in and went ahead and finished my degree in forestry.
Okay. So it was just kind of just almost like divine intervention.
Yeah, you know, maybe.
So, and you, obviously you are a hunter.
That's right.
And so what got you into hunting? Was it just like you just grew up doing it and basically?
Yeah. I grew up in a big rural county, big geographically and real small in population. I still don't think they have a stoplight in Sheraton County, Missouri. It's that rural. The county seat has 300 people.
Oh, yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, I just was, the nearest neighbor kids were several miles away, and I had to entertain myself. And I remember probably the first thing I hunted with was a spring-loaded BB gun. And it was, you know, the velocity was low enough you could see the BB traveling through the air.
Yep.
And so I started hunting grasshoppers and English sparrows with that. And then I graduated pump-up BB gun, and then I started killing things. And then it just went from there.
Okay. So then... So you're from Missouri, right?
That's correct.
What? How'd you end up in Alabama?
Well, I got my bachelor's of science in forestry at the University of Missouri, and I was getting ready to graduate, and I went and asked one of my professors. He said, "I'm thinking about going to get a master's degree. Where's the most stuff going on?" And he said it was down in the southeast at that time. This is where a lot of the timber's harvested, is where industry had a lot of jobs available. And he called Dr. Bob Mitchell, who's up at Auburn University. He had done his PhD at Missouri, and Bob had a place for a grad student at Auburn. I came down, studied longleaf pine, you know, Alabama state tree.
Yes, sir.
And from there, I was hired to work with longleaf pine. I worked for 20 years with Auburn University School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences and an organization called the Longleaf Alliance.
Okay.
Working to restore longleaf, I worked from Virginia to Texas was the range of the longleaf.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So with longleafs, I know that they are the main native pine tree around here, and like you said, so what are the benefits of a longleaf stand?
Well, if you're a hunter, you probably should know and appreciate longleaf pine, and that's who I worked with. Was a lot of people when I was doing my job, I was teaching people how to get the longleaf forest back, and what it was the forest industry was had started selling off most of their properties across the southeast, and people were buying it were people who had money, and oftentimes doctors and lawyers and other people of means, and they would buy this thick loblolly unburned stands that didn't have much wildlife habitat in it, and they wanted to convert it to longleaf because longleaf you could burn, you could use a lot of fire in it, it tends to have a more open canopy that gave us a lot more herbaceous growth. And that's what supports deer and turkey and quail and most of our game species. So the people who are buying that industry land where they were focused on growing the most wood in the shortest period of time and didn't care about wildlife, they were buying it and saying, no, the wildlife was the primary concern. And longleaf fits well with that.
Yeah. You know? So, I know at least on my hunting club and most places you see around here, it's just loblollies.
Yep.
And slash pines. I don't know if they still grow.
The slash and longleaf are very similar in that they're both pretty fire tolerant and produce a higher quality wood product naturally. They've genetically bred loblolly to where it's right in the ballpark with them, but it's loblolly doesn't like to be burned early.
Okay.
And we can get fire in there a lot. The quickest with longleaf pine. I mean, I've seen it planted and burned 2 weeks later and most of the seedlings survive. Yeah.
So, as I was saying, or what I was trying to get at kind of is, like, it's mostly loblollies on my hunting club, and at least 3/4 of it never been burned.
Yeah, and that's really not much fun to hunt in if you can't see 10 yards out away from you. And These longleaf stands, I hunted in on the Solon Dixon Center here in Covenant County and on the Conecuh. You could see to the next ridge. That might be, you know, half mile away. And that's a lot more fun for me.
Yeah, most people it is. Mm-hmm. I know I was listening to a different podcast, and they said they were talking about with the old growth longleafs back before logging was an industry. The understory, and I guess the midstory as well, was more of a grassland type habitat, but had pine trees in it.
There's a very famous ecologist from Florida named Reed Noss, and he instead of calling it the longleaf forest, he says it was a savanna, a grassland savanna with trees in it.
Exactly.
So that's a very appropriate description.
Exactly. So I know you're really passionate about the longleaf, so I wanted to bring that up.
No, I hear you.
So, what was I going to say? all right, so I guess we can roll into your style of hog hunting.
Okay.
Well, first off, sorry about this. Yeah. First off, so I wanted to kind of get your motivation for writing the book, The Year of the Pig.
All right.
The motivation to actually do that and achieve your goal,
right,
and then write the book.
Right. So I think you laid the groundwork here in the questions you've already asked. So I started hunting from the time I was old enough to, you know, carry a firearm.
Exactly.
On the farm. And then I spent 2 decades working to restore longleaf. And so we were spending all this time and effort trying to get this forest back. And it turns out feral hogs were undoing our efforts. And that's happening all over the Southeast. It's happening all over the world, for that matter, with feral pigs. And so I was still hunting. I was still working at restoring longleaf. I said, man, I can combine these. What I'll do is when I've killed a pig in 10 different states, I'm going to write my first book about it. And then in 2007, I found out it was the Chinese calendar year of the pig. And so I'm bad about procrastinating and putting things off. But if I set a hard goal, I'm pretty good about going at it. So I said, what I'll do is this year, 2007, I will try to kill a feral pig in at least 10 different states. And that's how I came up with the idea of the year of the pig, which is, it's, you know, a dual meaning. It was a year that I just went out and hunted the pigs, but it was also that Chinese calendar year.
Okay. So what motivated you, other than, you know, just being a hog hunter and knowing the detriment of pigs, what else motivated you to go to 10 different states? Like, that's a crazy goal for pretty much anybody. I mean, that's a crazy goal for a whitetail hunter, much less a pig hunter.
Yeah, I thought it was tough. I mean, I was working full time, putting in, you know, 50 hours a week with my full time job, and then I had to get out and go to all these different states and pursue pigs. So I said, that's a real challenge. I wanted it to be significant. And I wanted to, it was an excuse to get out and hunt a lot of areas I wouldn't hunt, but also to see how pigs behave differently in different ecosystems. So, you know, I was hunting swamps of South Alabama to the mountains of North Alabama to the backside of a dormant volcano on Maui Island and just everything in between. So I wanted to tell this the story of the pigs, but and also the hog hunters, all the ways that you could pursue feral pigs, which I pretty much covered it. I didn't kill any with the spear, but I killed multiple pigs with a knife in the dog hunting. I killed with archery, with black powder, with rimfire, with centerfire, and in many cases there were reasons why you had to use that weapon. For instance, if you were signing a wildlife refuge, a lot of the refuges here in the Southeast restrict you to certain calibers or or gauges of shotgun, depending upon the season. So during squirrel season, they were restricting us to rimfire ammunition. So I had to shoot rimfire if I wanted to hunt pigs. And then and other times it was just archery season, stuff like that. So I thought it would give me, it would give someone an idea of how they could pursue pigs in all different types of situations.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. I can't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure that after reading your book, like I had heard about the 17 HMR.
Yes.
But after reading your book, I'm pretty sure that's what motivated me to ask for one for Christmas.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
So now I have one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and I've yet to kill a pig with it, but I have obliterated a couple squirrels.
Yeah.
I refrain from anything other than headshots now.
Yeah. I gotcha.
But I really want to kill a pig with that.
It's a tiny, tiny bullet. I mean, the standard is 17 grains, and you know, which is smaller than your 22.
Exactly.
But what I did was I got every bullet that was out there, and I tested them. I just tested them under all types of situations. I got the trajectories down and the penetration, and there was two that were feasible. the full metal jacket, and then the 20 grain HMR instead of the normal 17, because most of the rounds you buy are designed for squirrels and stuff. Then you get zero penetration. You could shoot pigs all day long, and you're just, it's just going to blow up on beneath the skin. It's not going to hurt them. But with these two bullets, and I really liked the 20 grain HMR, I was getting fantastic penetration, and you just, your shot placement just has to be absolutely precise.
Oh yeah.
And so I practiced with squirrels and small birds and stuff like that, and got to where I was comfortable, and I killed quite a few pigs in a row. In fact, I think my first 10 shots in a row killed pigs.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So mine is a Henry lever action, and I noticed that most of the 17 grain bullets won't group as well as the 20 grains. And I think the brand I'm using is CCI, but I'm not exactly sure. But yeah, I've also seen videos of the 17 grain ones, people shooting it into a grape.
Yeah.
And it disintegrating after that.
Yeah.
So that perfectly explains what you're talking about the smaller grains are used for, like, 100% smaller game.
I killed several pigs with that gun in the book, but the biggest one was a mature boar on Bioca Codri over in Wildlife Refuge in Louisiana. And it was a mature boar, and I made sure his shoulder was forward and went behind it and went through the lungs, and it went all the way over and lodged beneath the skin on the opposite shoulder. So that tells you the type of penetration it was getting.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So that kind of leads us into your style of pig hunting, which is something that I find very interesting. You never see anything like that on TV. And it is... Yeah. I have to say, it's pretty hard to duplicate if you don't know what you're doing. Because I've tried it a couple times.
So which style did you try?
The point blank.
Oh, yeah.
Point blank hog hunting. Have you ever spent any time in the Escambia River public land in that area?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's where I've tried it. And as you know, it is like super thick. And it seems like the perfect place to do your style of hunting. But if you don't know that much about pigs and you've never really done it, it's very difficult. So can you kind of explain like what point blank hog hunting is?
Okay. Well, the pigs behave differently depending on where they are, but part of it has to do with the environment. A lot of it has to do with how much hunting pressure they're subjected to. So if you don't hunt pigs at all, they're going to be out all day long. And you can walk right up to them on some areas where they're protected from hunting. When you subject them to a lot of pressure, they tend to go mostly nocturnal. And so they, and during the day, there's certain types of habitats that they really like to get into. And that tends to be the thickest, nastiest stuff you can find. And it's oftentimes near water. So I think the chapters you're talking about, a lot of it, it was in Privet, it was in Tie-Tie,
oh, yeah.
And it was near swamps, and mostly around Covington, Escambia County, Alabama. And I knew the pigs were in there. Oftentimes, if you was quiet and listening, you could hear a pig squeal or the little ones, and I'd know they'd be in there, and they'd have these hog trails that go through stuff that was way too thick to walk through. So the only way that's going to work pretty much is to get down on your hands and knees and crawl in those trails. And generally, you know, in that situation, you're not going to be wanting a scoped rifle. You're going to be wanting a shotgun and buckshot or something like that, because it's going to be really, really close, and going to happen really, really fast. And I know feral pigs have a tremendous reputation for being aggressive and all that, but it was pretty rare for them to come after me unless I didn't give them an avenue to escape. So it's a kind of an ultimate adrenaline rush to just be within, you know, you're maybe at the most 10 yards away from these big feral pigs, and they do have some damage to the capability of hurting you, but if you're not scared of them, most of the time they're not going to come after you. Most of the time.
I have been false charged one time.
Yeah.
Well, technically two times, but it was the same pig. So me and a buddy were walking around. It was bow season, and we were walking around a swampy area. And sorry about the train, by the way. But we were walking around a swampy area, and all we had was our bows.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew there were pigs, but we weren't really thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll let this train pass. The train's a lot louder in here than it is inside.
Mm.
But so either way, we were walking through the swamps with our bows, and we were looking for squirrels, and like we were just kids messing around. We noticed we were old enough to know like what hog sign looked like, and we looked on the edge of an old wet weather pond,
mm-hmm.
and there was just tons of fresh rooting right along the edge of it. And I was like, that stuff's still like wet. Like that looks super fresh. And I told my buddy, I was like, we might need to get real quiet, you know, and just see what happens. We walk about 20 yards and I didn't hear them at all. I don't know why, but all of a sudden we see at least 20 pigs just run from our left across straight out in front of us to our right into some thick stuff. And it was just crazy. Like, it was just pure chaos. 20 to 25 pigs. And then, like, piglets nearly ran into us. And then they got on, and we were like, what just happened? Wow. And then all of a sudden, we look up, and there's, like, probably a 120 to 150-pound boar. And you could, like, see his cutters and everything.
Uh-huh.
And he turned back around at us and, like, ran at us.
Mm-hmm.
And then stopped about 30 yards out,
mm-hmm.
and he like snorted and just kind of eased off. And then we were like, oh my God. And I couldn't get a shot because it was too thick. And I was like, let's just sit here for a second and then try to follow him. And then we moved up a little ways, about 15 yards, and I hear something, and I'm like, get down, get down. And we get down on our knees, look up, same boar charges within 20, 30 yards, and just stops, stares at us, snorts, and just eases off. And we never saw those pigs again.
It's fun.
Oh, yeah, it is. But, so yeah, that's kind of point-blank hog hunting.
That's it.
It's something I'm definitely going to try again in the future and try to actually get decent at it. But, so another interesting point from the book was eBay hunts.
Oh, yeah.
I've never heard of anybody. I mean, this was in 2007, but I've never heard of anybody else looking up hunts on eBay.
I said I wanted to do it every which way that was possible, just, you know, to give people an idea.
Exactly.
And literally there was hog hunts for auction up on eBay. And I said that one... turned out, if you've read the book, it wasn't much of a hunt. It was equivalent. Have you heard of put and shoot quail hunting?
Where they just release the tag pigeons?
Yeah, you pin raise them, you throw them out in the morning, and the hunters come in and try to get them to fly and shoot them. Okay, exactly. Well, that's what that was. And so, when you boy, I hate to give away all the
I'm gonna veer away from the book here in a minute, but
give it all away. But that's, it's a real risk. I try, I don't pay for hog hunts now. I did it because that I wanted to tell the story, the broad spectrum from just hardcore walking and stalking through swamps and in wild public lands to paying for the hunt, and. And I tell the stories. There's legitimate hunts that you can buy out there, and there's a lot of them that are not legitimate.
Exactly.
When you boil it down.
So I meant to mention this when we were talking about point blank hog hunting, but one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, did you ever get a sidearm for pigs?
I did.
Okay.
I did. Well, I didn't necessarily get it for pigs. I got it for my next book, which was, okay. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I resigned from this job after 20 years that I'm in the book with the Longleaf Alliance at Auburn University. And I went and became the first person in history to walk the entire U.S.-Mexico border.
Really?
So, yeah. So that's, first I went out to just walk the Texas-Mexico border in 2014. So this is 7 years after the year of the pig.
Okay.
And I carried a sidearm with me there.
I can imagine you need to.
I almost got a chance to kill some pigs down on some real remote roads because there's a lot of feral pigs. It's Texas.
Yes, sir.
And so when I was beside the Rio Grande, for 7 weeks walking. And,
wow.
It just never quite clicked, but I came real close to being able to shoot and cook one over a fire on the banks of the Rio Grande.
That would have been cool.
Yeah.
So what is the name of your new book?
That's Border Walk.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when does it release?
Oh, it's out.
It's out? It's out. Okay.
In fact, it came out, and they even made a movie about me that played on PBS called La Frontera. Yeah.
I'll have to check that out. When I looked you up to see if you want to do the podcast, I saw the cover page of the book, but I didn't really look into it too much, but I'll definitely check that out.
Oh, yeah. It's fun.
So, another thing. So, have you ever hunted javelinas? Have you ever spent any time over there?
I wanted to. I saw a lot of them on my walk on the Texas border. And I put in and got drawn for a New Mexico hunt on public lands. And this was right after I did the border walk. And my wife said, no, you're going to stay here and help. She gave me all the time away that she was going to let me for a while. And so I have not had an opportunity to kill a javelina yet. No.
Okay. That just popped in my mind. Yeah. In the Southwest, So one thing that I really liked about your book, I'm not very good at the segues or anything.
Sure.
I'm just sort of stuff that pops into my mind and the stuff I've got written out. Yeah. But one of the things I really liked about your book is the fact that you put all these facts about different types of trees and different plants as the opening to the chapter.
Oh, I'm glad you liked that. Yeah.
I really thought that was interesting.
Excuse me. There was I put in one or two of those descriptions, just kind of a, I guess you'd have to read it, to understand what we're talking about. But I try to catch the spirit of the tie swamps. I try to catch the spirit of the longleaf pine, and because I just am deeply connected with the environment. And I did a couple of them, and the copy editor who was going through my book said, those are really nice. She said, you should do that with every chapter where it fit. And I added a bunch more back in right at the end. And I really enjoyed those.
Oh yeah. That was something I thought was really interesting. It kind of helps you see not only what's going on, but if you're even a little bit familiar with botany and forestry, mm-hmm. like, my dad's a forester, so I've been, or he used to be. Mm-hmm. And so I know a thing or two about trees. And just being able to read, like, the species and then, like, the description, it kind of puts it into place, like, exactly what that is.
That's
especially,
cool.
like, hunting in areas
that's,
similar to that.
That's what I was hoping to do. I'm really proud to hear that.
That's awesome. Yeah. So kind of getting back into hog hunting, it's something that you mentioned in the book, but it's not really going to give away too much because I kind of want to, I would like for people to read the book.
I would too.
And so I don't want to give away everything, but you talk about how inexperienced people such as myself would have trouble distinguishing sign between like one pig or 500 pigs.
That's right.
And I can definitely attest to that. So what are a few things you look for to tell like how fresh hog rooting is, hog sign is, and like how many there might be?
Ooh, well, that's a good question because what I saw on a frequent basis when a sounder would move into an area, and if a sow or a few sows and her piglets set up shop in a stream and stay in a small area, they just root up the whole world. But it might be five pigs, and it looks exactly. Like you're saying, it looks like 500 is out there. How do you determine how fresh it is? You know, that gets down to experience, to studying the pig. There's one pig in there that I went after 50 times over a year pursuing.
The one just, in the beginning?
Yeah, and just learning his habits. And he was almost completely nocturnal. He would just come out on the edges of fields at certain times, generally about 2 o'clock in the morning and stuff like that. And you, it helps that I was a trapper. And trappers, I trapped for many years. I did it all the way through high school, and then I trapped for timber companies on beavers and stuff. And
you so just like fur trapping,
the fur trapping, okay. Yeah. And you learn to read sign.
Oh yeah.
And if you stay serious on hunting, you know, I think that's where we're getting away. We're losing a lot of our skills. I have a good friend who's one of the best naturalists I know up in South Carolina, and most of the guys he works with, the only way they know to kill a deer is to pour out corn and wait for the deer to come to the corn. And that's how a lot of people, unfortunately, that's what they associate with hunting. If you learn how to read the sign and the trail and the pattern, that's something different. But
oh, yeah.
The more you do it, the better you'll get at it.
Yeah, that's one thing. Like, I would definitely 100% say I'm not an expert in much at all, especially not hunting. I've just done it a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to trap a little bit just so I could have something to do after school and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And mainly coons and possums. And mm-hmm. I've tried my hand at like bobcats, coyotes, and foxes and just not had much luck.
I wasn't any good at the dry land trapping, the coyotes and that type of stuff. I was always a water trapper.
Okay. Yeah. I've caught one beaver. And I actually filmed all that and put it on the YouTube channel. That was pretty cool. I caught it in a snare because that's the only legal way to do it in Florida.
Yeah, I knew they didn't let you use leg holds and stuff down here. Yeah.
But I have noticed that, now, I'm definitely not trying to bash Cade, who's the other guy in 25, but there every now and then I will notice that, and I think it comes from my trapping experience, that I'll pick up on small things that he might not pick up on.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I point it out, he's like, oh, okay, and sees it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not like it's just like he kind of overlooks some things. But, I mean, he's still a great hunter, you know. And but it's just one thing I've noticed. If you do trap at least, I mean, if you trap one season and you catch a few animals, you know, you really can pick up on some stuff that other people might not. You just sort of know what to look for.
Yeah, learning the sign. I think that's a really important part of it.
So, kind of going from there, one thing I would like to hear is, like, what was your experience, or what did you take from your experience hunting in Hawaii? Because that's something I'm pretty interested in.
Yeah. Well, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I think one of the, it's going to be really tough for you to do much hunting in Hawaii without paying for a hunt. That's the thing. There's just not going to be the public lands. There's not going to be that opportunity unless you do what I did, which is pay for a guy who had an exclusive lease on 3 cattle ranches. And then, exactly. And then he took me out. And then it was like, almost like shooting pigs, fish in a barrel, as they say, you know. I've said pigs in a barrel, but there was a lot of pigs. There was a lot of goats.
Oh yeah, you also hunted goats up there.
I killed several goats. They were really pretty, neat animals. And there was a bunch of other stuff that I didn't hunt during my short time there. But it's almost all introduced species. That's one neat point about Hawaii is they've had pigs longer than any other state. The natives of Hawaii brought them on their rafts, they think, about 800 years ago. And so they've had some very long established pig populations. And I talk about this some in my book, but you can tell how long the population of pigs has been feral by the angle of the snout. And when it's very old feral populations, it has a very low angle. It's a very extended snout. It's not got this real steep, not steep angle like you see on a Yorkshire or Hampshire pig.
Okay.
So pigs that are fairly new to the wilds, maybe one or two generations, have very steep angles to the skull. And in those long time feral populations, like I saw in South Florida and parts of Louisiana, they had those real extended snouts on them.
Okay. Yeah, that's one thing I've heard is the Hawaiian, or somebody from like mainland government, like from our government, was like, or from, I maybe it may have been federal, told the Hawaiians, it's like, look, we need to get these pigs out of here. They're an invasive species and stuff. And then the Hawaiian natives were like, hold up, like, those pigs have been there as long as we have. So if you're going to get rid of them, you may as well get rid of us, too.
I think I touch on this in my book. I am a forester and ecologist, and I don't like what pigs do to the longleaf ecosystem. But they've been, in a lot of those systems, they've been there for 800 years. And whatever species they were going to drive extinct, that happened 700 years ago.
Exactly.
And those ranches I was hunting on weren't making enough money raising cattle to keep it from being turned into development. But they could raise the cattle, plus sell the hunts, and they were able to do that. And I would rather them have feral pigs and whatever impact they have on the environment than see it turn into subdivisions.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. Another thing that I've heard about Hawaii that I thought was interesting, I don't know if it's 100% true, but I've heard that the goats actually cause more damage to the native wildlife or the native flowers and plant life than the pigs do.
I would say it probably depends. I can see, you know, pigs root and goats graze. Mm-hmm. And if you got a lot of goats, they graze everything down to nothing. That's how you open up a thick patch of brush and put goats in there. So I could see them doing more damage in some systems. And then in other maybe wetland type systems, I could see where the pigs would probably be the worst of the pair. Okay. So it probably depends, but that may be accurate.
Okay. Yeah. I was looking in, it was a couple years ago. I learned that there was, I want to say, Columbia blacktails in Hawaii that were introduced.
I know they had, I believe you're correct. Plus, they've got some of like the Sika or the, you know, those Asian deer.
Okay,
they got some of those too. Sika or fallow, I can't remember which one. And they had grouse. And they had
grouse out there.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Some of the African, what are those African birds?
Guineas?
Chuckers and stuff
chuckers.
Like
that. Okay.
I mean, it was just everything, everything out there.
So, but yeah, I was looking into information about it may be a Sitka blacktail. I'm not 100% sure which type of blacktail, but either way, what I was looking at was, like, people were saying, yeah, they're here, but it's one of the most difficult things to hunt in Hawaii. Like, I've hunted for 10 years for them and seen two.
Oh, wow.
Like, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And one person, I only found two forums on the entire internet that had anything about blacktail hunting in Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
And one of them, someone was like, don't waste your time, and that was it. And then the other one, there was like four people that replied.
Oh,
and it said the goats moved into this one drainage where there used to be a fairly decent population of the blacktails, and the goats pushed them into this really, really thick drainage.
Mm-hmm.
And because when the goats moved in, they ate all of the native flora and fauna.
Oh, wow.
So the blacktails didn't have anything to eat, so they were forced into the thick stuff. And the blacktails were also introduced, so, I mean, it's...
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what's worse, but going from Hawaii, mm-hmm. We talked about all sorts of stuff, hog hunting, talked about your motivation to do this. What was your favorite state that you hunted in over the course of this this book?
I had a lot of fun, but I think the best hunt, the one I enjoyed the most, was with my good friend John Dixon, hunting over in Biococodri in Louisiana. And we spent, you know, 3 days wading through blue palm chasing pigs, and then that 3 days we fired our weapons one time. And I won't tell, I mean, I've given some away earlier, but it was a fun hunt. It's a lot more fun for me to pursue something really, really hard and think it's not going to happen, and then to be surprised in a certain way. And that's kind of the elements that were there. And I it was fun hunting in big, mature hardwoods and
a
system like that.
I have a very similar viewpoint about, like, the difficulty of the hunt is, like, a big part of it to me as well. We were talking about, I was at Cade's hunting camp last night. We were talking about, like, high fence stuff. And he's like, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't pay for a hunt. But if someone said, here's a $30,000 deer, if you want to kill it for free, go ahead, then I would do it. But to me, I was like, no, I wouldn't do that at all, you know. Like, for me, that's not a deer at that point. But just personally, but...
Yeah. I've gotten, I guess, more restrictive in what I'm going to hunt and how I'm going to hunt as you know. And I give slack to someone who just is not as experienced and doesn't grow up in the country. Maybe that's just all they're ever going to be able to do in certain situations. So I'm not going to judge them, but that's not for me.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, to being a hunter who enjoys hunting public land with a bow, and if I had it my way, every deer I ever killed would be a mature buck because it has the least impact on the population. You know, it's a better, to me, it's better because they're more difficult. Mm-hmm. Being that that's what I enjoy, I wouldn't do that. But, I mean, like, I think you mentioned in the book, like, if someone's disabled or they're older or they're trying to get into it even, and they just don't have the experience to go out and hunt, you know, it's not a bad thing at all.
Yeah.
And another thing that I've noticed is with high fence ranches, there's been a lot of good science that came from those about white-tailed deer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the CWD thing that's bad, and that most likely originated from a high fence ranch, but there's a lot of good that comes from from them based like science wise. Mm-hmm. And even we have a sponsorship for the show called Native Sense. Mm-hmm. And they produce 100% tested, clean deer urine that's legal in the state of Alabama. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we actually, our last podcast was with Zach New, who is the I think he's the owner of that company. And he's got a lot of good information about how deer act, mm-hmm. even though most of his experience is working on a deer farm.
I see.
So, I mean, it has its positives and its negatives in my mind, but, you know, it's just another thing.
That's right.
So, was there anything else you wanted to kind of close with?
Well, I guess, and I talk about it in the book, you know, it's just that I encourage everybody to learn more about our native forest and to take care of them. And some places that means we need to really reduce or even wipe the pigs out.
Exactly.
You know, don't put them where they aren't there. Don't move them around. There's plenty of people who don't want them and need help getting rid of them. And there's... Gosh, right down here where, you know, in Florida, there's probably 300 different public areas you can hunt on. In Alabama, there's quite a few there, and they've gotten established on the Talladega. We wiped them out of the Conecuh, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, we cleaned them clear out. It's been several years since we've had any reproduction on the Dixon Center where I work or the Conecuh.
Yes,
that's one misnomer or misbelief I think that some people have is that you can't get rid of them. We got rid of them on probably about a 250,000 acre range.
Really?
Yeah. And
I have noticed that, like, we have a lease that's right next to the Conecuh National, and there's a very small section that borders the river, the uh-huh. Conecuh River, uh-huh. and every now and then we'll get some pigs running up the river. Mm-hmm. And usually if they stay in our little section, we can drive them out pretty quick. Mm-hmm. But... it seems like when I was a kid, when hog hunting was all the rage and everybody was all over TV, and it seemed like it was the height of people carrying them around in the bed of their trucks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There were just hogs everywhere. And now, at least in South Alabama, it seems like the population's gone way down.
It has in some areas, but the northern end of Covenant County where I live, it's okay. going up.
Really?
Yeah, there's some... I think you're going to see... that the population, if you got a whole bunch of absentee landowners who aren't there to pay attention to it, you're gonna and once hogs are in, they're just gonna keep on going, and that's how. So there's a lot of different things that are happening across the range, but in some areas it seems like they're going the population's going up quite a bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I've got just a couple follow-ups.
Yeah, sure.
So one thing you mentioned in the book was how in some of the unburnt loblolly mm-hmm. stands of pines, the pigs aren't really doing a ton of damage.
That's right.
And uh-huh. that's another thing that I've noticed on the Scambia River public mm-hmm. land. Like, there's a ton of hog sign, but... it's not like they're destroying anything out there.
Yeah.
And I see more deer than I do pigs out there, but there's probably more pigs.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that was something interesting.
Yeah, I think there's areas where it's they're having not as much impact as some people make it out to be. There are those areas. I think that's true.
You mentioned it towards the end that you were probably not going to duplicate anything like this. But it kind of sounds like you have in a way. So in this book, you hunt 10 states mm-hmm. in 1 year
mm-hmm.
for pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And then 7 years later, you make a how many mile trek along the...
by the end of it, I walked 2,000 miles.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, that was pretty intense.
So
yeah.
would you say that was a bit of a... of a duplicate of a similar kind of thing?
Yes, I guess I'm kind of setting a trend in that I write nonfiction adventure.
Okay.
All right. And that's what I did with Year of the Pig. And I thought, man, I may never have an opportunity to do something that fun again. But then I went and walked the border, and it was the most exciting thing I've ever done. So until my body falls apart, I'm gonna keep doing these things. I've got several ideas of other books I want to write. And
okay.
I'm gonna keep it rolling.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So your book Year of the Pig and your book Border Walk. Mm-hmm. Where can people find those?
They can pick them up through any major online bookseller like Amazon, Barnes and Noble. They can pick them up there. They can visit my, I've got a website called www.sweetbill.com. That's what we operate under, our kind of our farmer's market thing, business we have going. And I'll mail one and sign one and mail one if you order it through sweetbill.com. Otherwise, yeah, the major online bookstores. There's a scattering around down here in Fairhope. Page and Pallet had carried my books for a while. I don't know if they still have them. I hope they do. They might have a few.
So, one final kind of thing. The way I found your book was very interesting.
I want to hear this. Yeah,
my sister. She went to school at Ole Miss.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're familiar with the Square Bookstore.
I've done two book signings there.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's probably explains why I found your book there. We were up there.
Oh my gosh.
I wonder if it was, I think it was like her first year up there.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, we got to go to the Square Bookstore because it's like iconic bookstore in Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And so we walked in. And everybody was looking at, you know, whatever they were into. And then I found this one little section that had, like, hunting books.
Uh-huh.
And I just pulled out a random one that said Year of the Pig. Hey. And I was like, this seems interesting. I started flipping through. And I was like, this guy lives not too far from me.
That's
works
funny.
Right up the road from where I hunt.
That's crazy.
And I just thought that was so, so cool to, you know, see that. Getting the book from 600 miles away, 500 or however many miles away.
That's one of my favorite bookstores. They're really good people there.
Square
Books, yeah.
And then the other day I was riding around, what gave me the idea to call you and see if you'd like to do a podcast was I was driving to a piece of public land that I saw on Google Maps, and I was like, that looks like it might be a good spot. And I drove past the Solon Dixon Center. And I was like, hey, I got an idea. But you got, I just asked you this, but do you have any other concluders that you'd like to throw in?
No, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate on this podcast with you.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on. So I guess we're going to wrap up. Like I said, I really appreciate it. You can find Mr. Mark's books on probably Amazon or definitely Amazon and other online retailers. Sweetbill.com, is that what you
That's
said?
That's right.
You can find them there. And I really hope you guys check out this book, and I'm definitely going to check out the new one, Border Walk. So, well, I guess that's going to do it for today. I don't really know how to close out a podcast. It's my first time actually hosting it myself. So I guess we'll just see you guys later.
All right.